I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Speaking earlier this week to the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC, President Obama said that if Iran developed nuclear weapons, it would be a threat to Israel, the region, and the United States. He told Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that the U.S. will always have Israel's back, although the president favors sanctions and diplomacy over military force for now. This week at a press conference, Mr. Obama chided his Republican critics and presidential challengers for their casual talk about war with Iran. So today in Radio Times, what to do about a nuclear Iran, and we do have two guests who have joined us. Alireza Nader is a senior international policy analyst at the RAND Corporation, a co-author of Coping with a Nuclearizing Iran and Israel and Iran, a Dangerous Rivalry, joining us from their studios. And Ali, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Also with us is Matthew Kranig. He's an assistant professor of government at Georgetown University and a Stanton Nuclear Security Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, author of Exporting the Bomb, Technology Transfer, and the Spread of Nuclear Weapons. And Matthew Kranig, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well. All right, let's get him up. Ali, let me begin with you.
Sure.
How close do you think Iran is to building a nuclear weapon?
It's not as close as it is often depicted. We know that Iran is enriching uranium, especially to higher levels that can be used potentially to create a nuclear weapon. But Iran also needs to create the actual nuclear weapon and also put it on top of a missile. And we have to remember that Iran is under international supervision, under IAEA supervision. So if it wants to take these steps, it will be detected. So it's not that Iran is moving toward a nuclear weapons capability as quickly as possible. In fact, the U.S. intelligence community has assessed that Iran hasn't even made the decision to assemble a nuclear weapon. It's just building the capability to do so if it chooses that option in the future.
Let me quote something from the Associated Press today. Satellite imagery of an Iranian military facility appears to show trucks and earth-moving vehicles at the site, indicating an attempted cleanup of radioactive traces possibly left by tests of a nuclear weapon trigger, diplomats told the Associated Press. And these are diplomats associated with the IAEA. What do you make of that, Ali?
The IAEA has stated that there is evidence to suggest Iran is conducting research on nuclear weapons. In the latest IAEA report, there were suspicions raised of Iran developing nuclear weapons capability, not just having uranium enrichment. Unfortunately, Iran has not allowed the IAEA to inspect some of its suspected military sites, like the site Parchin, and it's not clear if it is going to do so in the future. There have been some signals from Iran that it's willing to open up its military sites, but again, it's been very reluctant. It's hard to tell really what Iran is up to if we don't have access to those sites.
And I do want to get back to that. Let me get Matthew Kranig in on our conversation. Welcome to Radio Times.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you here. And let me put the question I put to Ali. From your perspective, how close do you think Iran is to building a nuclear weapon?
Well, I don't think Ali and I disagree on the basic facts, but he gave kind of the glass half full perspective. I'll give the glass half empty. Once Iran has significant quantities of highly enriched uranium, actually fashioning a simple nuclear device is fairly easy. So really the question is how long until Iran can have enough highly enriched uranium for its first nuclear weapon. So right now we estimate that if they made the decision today, they can have enough highly enriched uranium within about 6 months. But that timeline is shrinking as more and more centrifuges come online. So by the end of the year, experts estimate that dash time, the time it would take Iran to get enough material for its first weapon once it said go, would shrink to about 1 month. So really over the course of this year, I think we're going to have to start making some difficult decisions on how we want to deal with this problem. Iran is close, and it's getting closer by the day.
And Matthew, if Iran gets a nuclear weapon, do you think they'll use it for offensive reasons or defensive reasons?
Well, I think nuclear-armed Iran would pose a grave threat to international peace and security. I don't think that Iran would get nuclear weapons and intentionally launch a suicidal nuclear war. But that said, there's still a lot of things that could go wrong. I think a nuclear-armed Iran would lead to the further spread of nuclear weapons in the Middle East, as other countries tried to get nuclear weapons in response. I think Iran itself could become a nuclear supplier, providing uranium enrichment technology to U.S. enemies around the world. I think Iran would likely become more aggressive in its foreign policy, stepping up support to terrorist groups, becoming more aggressive in terms of coercive diplomacy. So this could mean an even more crisis-prone Middle East. And with nuclear weapons, any one of these crises could escalate into a nuclear exchange. Given Israel's small size, a nuclear exchange could very well result in the destruction of the State of Israel. And Iran is developing ballistic missile capabilities. Former Defense Secretary Gates estimated that Iran could have ballistic missiles capable of reaching the east coast of the United States within 5 years. So one of these crises could very well escalate and result in a nuclear detonation on the U.S. homeland. So I think a nuclear-armed Iran poses a grave threat.
Ali, would you say that the goal is to prevent Iran from developing nuclear weapons, and what the disagreement is about is how to achieve that goal?
Among some people, right now the United States has a policy of relying on sanctions and diplomacy engagement to dissuade Iran from weaponizing its nuclear program. Iran has not crossed the red line of weaponization. And again, there's no proof that the leadership in Tehran actually intends to weaponize the program. However, by threatening Iran, militarily especially, we actually raise the chances of Iran weaponizing its program, because we have to look at why Iran is developing potential or alleged nuclear weapons capability. And the reason for this is mainly insecurity. They're worried about the United States, U.S. military capabilities, but especially the Iranian regime is worried that the United States wants to overthrow it in the future, as happened with the Saddam Hussein regime and the Taliban in Afghanistan. So yes, in some ways, a nuclear-armed Iran can be emboldened in the Middle East. There are a lot of ifs, but right now, looking at Iran, it is in a very vulnerable position in the Middle East. Its power is actually receding. We've had officials of Hamas, for example, say that they won't back Iran in a war with Israel and Iran. So there are a lot of ways Iran can be contained and dissuaded from developing a weapons program. And that's why the Obama administration at this point is relying on additional pressures and engagement with Iran to achieve its objectives.
Matthew, let me go back to you. When we're talking about this this conflict between Iran, Israel, and obviously involving the United States as well, but Israel has nuclear weapons. How can they, in a sense, prevent another country from getting nuclear weapons if they have them themselves?
Yeah, well, Iran is a signatory of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, an international treaty established in 1970. It's near universal. So in signing the treaty and becoming a part of the nuclear nonproliferation regime, Iran agreed never to acquire nuclear weapons. And in exchange for that commitment, Iran received a number of benefits, including peaceful nuclear assistance from nuclear states and from the International Atomic Energy Agency. So Iran has international obligations not to acquire nuclear weapons. Israel never signed the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, so it doesn't have the same kind of obligations.
But it has nuclear weapons, does it not?
Yeah. So Israel has nuclear weapons. They first developed nuclear weapons, we think, in about 1967, so they've had them for a very long time now. Putting the genie back in the bottle is very difficult. I think there are many people in the United States who would like to get rid of nuclear weapons in Israel, North Korea, Pakistan, and a lot of other places, but it's difficult to put the genie back in the bottle. The reason Iran is different in part is because Iran doesn't yet have nuclear weapons, so we still have an opportunity here to prevent the further spread of the world's most dangerous weapons.
But Ali, does this complicate whether it's negotiations or sanctions or even military strike that we're talking about a country, Israel, with nuclear weapons?
Well, Matthew is correct. Iran is a signatory to the NPT. It can withdraw from the NPT and then go ahead and develop nuclear weapons. And this is a major problem with Iran's policy. We suspected of developing a nuclear weapons capability under the NPT. So a lot of people argue that it is in violation of the NPT. Mm-hmm. However, Iran has argued that why should a country like Israel have a nuclear weapons capability while other Middle Eastern countries, especially Muslim countries, do not have that capability? And to some extent, this resonates among Arab publics in the Middle East. For example, in Egypt, the Egyptians make the same argument that while Israel has nuclear weapons, they don't want Iran to have nuclear weapons, but they argue for a nuclear weapons-free zone in the Middle East.
Let me go back to you, Matthew, and even going back to some of the speeches that were given earlier this week, whether at AIPAC or on the campaign trail or President Obama's press conference. Do you think the region is closer to some kind of, if not war, some kind of deeper conflict after all the talk this week?
Well, Israel finds itself in a difficult situation because they clearly want to prevent Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons. And they do have a military option to do that. They could strike Iran's key nuclear facilities, but Israel's military option isn't great. They don't have the same capabilities that the United States does. So Israel right now faces a kind of now or never situation with its military option. It could strike now and set back Iran's nuclear program, but its window for effective military action is rapidly closing as Iran puts more and more of its sensitive nuclear facilities underground. So those are going to be more difficult for Israel to get. So if Israel doesn't strike now, then its non-proliferation policy with Iran becomes trusting the United States, trusting that the United States will take military action later if necessary to prevent Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons. The United States has, again, greater capabilities, so we could get those buried and hardened facilities that Israel would have a hard time getting. So it's hard to say what Israel would do. Putting complete faith in the United States to take care of the Iran problem would be a difficult thing, I think, for any sovereign country to do. I do think that there were good signs coming out of the meeting. I think that the risk of war is perhaps slightly lower than it was before the meetings. But I do think that there's a significant risk that over the next 6 months or so, Israel will decide to take military action to try to destroy Iran's key nuclear facilities.
And Ollie, we're about 30 seconds from our first break here. Mm-hmm. Do you want to just comment on that particular comment?
I think the threat of war has receded to some extent, but I think we've just kicked the can down the road. The crisis with Iran is not over, and there is a significant chance that Israel might attack Iran and drag the United States into a war it does not want.
We're going to take a very short break. We are talking about what to do about a nuclear Iran, and that's Alireza Nader, a senior international policy analyst at the RAND Corporation, in fact, joining us from their studios. Also with us is Matthew Kranig, and he's an assistant professor of government at Georgetown University and a Stanton Nuclear Security Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. What do you think should be done about Iran? Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Chester County Hospital supports WHYY and is committed to delivering comprehensive care in an environment where respect, compassion, and quality come first. To learn how they help make lives better every day, ChesterCountyHospital.org.
This is Ira Glass of This American Life, and I'm excited to announce that I'm coming to Princeton, New Jersey to give a talk about how we put together our radio show each week. I'll be playing clips and favorite stories, and I can basically mix the show on stage live as you watch. And unlike some other public radio hosts, I do not sing. It'll be Sunday, April 29th, 3 in the afternoon at the MacArthur Theater in Princeton. Proceeds benefit WHYY. For more information, visit whyy.org/member experience.
The Discover Newsworks Discover the Philadelphia Region sweepstakes. Newsworks.org is giving away great prizes to our Facebook fans. This week, two tickets to see God of Carnage at the Walnut Street Theater. Visit Facebook.com/Newsworks and enter weekly. Share with your friends for extra chances to win. You must like Newsworks on Facebook to enter. No purchase necessary. For a complete list of rules, go to Newsworks.org. Newsworks.org, powered by WHYY and you. Smart. Local. News.
Seventh Generation supports WHYY, makers of plant-based 4X laundry detergent, a cold water clean in a cardboard bottle. Energy and money-saving laundry tips are available at 7thGeneration.com. Seventh Generation, caring today for seven generations of tomorrows.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Matthew Kranig and Alireza Nader, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Ali, how effective do you think the sanctions have been so far? And this is something that the president talked about earlier this week.
They've definitely damaged Iran's economy, especially U.S. sanctions targeting the central bank in Iran and also the European oil embargo that's supposed to take effect this summer, but which has already created a lot of widespread panic in Iran. The currency has depreciated. There's a climate of fear in Iran, not just due to sanctions, but also threats of war. So the Iranian population is feeling the pressure, and members of the elite as well. But it's not clear whether the Iranian government is going to really back down on the nuclear program. And just listening to Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, he has stated that he's going to meet pressure with pressure and that he's not going to back down in the face of Western pressures. And in fact, Iran is accelerating its program. So at this point, we have to wait and see what happens with sanctions. The indicators are not entirely positive.
Matthew, let me go to you, and then I do want to get to some of our callers here. But do you have any faith in diplomacy, Matthew?
Well, I think we all hope that we can somehow get a diplomatic settlement to this problem because the alternatives are so much worse, which would be either a military strike or living with a nuclear-armed Iran. So we can all hope, but I think it's unlikely that we can actually get a diplomatic settlement. And part of the reason is that nuclear weapons would be very valuable for Iran. Their two primary strategic goals are to continue to exist as a state, for the current theocratic regime to continue to exist, and also to become the most dominant power in the region. And so getting nuclear weapons would help them achieve both of those goals. And right now, as I pointed out earlier in the show, we think they're months away from having that capability. So that's pretty valuable. I think that they're going to be very unlikely to trade that away. So, again, we can hold out hope, but I think it's unlikely that we're going to get Iran to make serious concessions and to put meaningful curbs on its nuclear program.
And under what circumstances do you think a military strike would be effective?
Well, so the alternatives, a strike or a nuclear-armed Iran, neither are attractive options. I think that a military strike is the least bad of the two options. A U.S. strike could certainly destroy Iran's key nuclear facilities. It would set the program back at a minimum a number of years. But the hope would be, of course, that that delay would somehow become permanent and we could keep Iran from nuclear weapons permanently. There would be risks, of course, to a strike, including Iranian retaliation, but I think that those risks are less severe than many people assume they would be, and that the United States could put in place a strategy to manage and mitigate some of those downside risks.
Do you see risk in a military strike, Ali? And then we will get to our callers.
Yes, there are huge risks, and we have to be careful not to underestimate those risks. Basically, if there's a military strike against Iran, especially an Israeli strike, we assess, or the U.S. government assesses, and the Israelis assess that it would only damage the program and not set it back. Even U.S. military strikes are not guaranteed to destroy the program because Iran has developed the knowledge and the know-how to enrich uranium and potentially assemble a weapon. And so we could have a regional war, a third war in the Middle East for the United States after Iraq and Afghanistan that really jeopardizes U.S. and political, economic, and military objectives in the region. We've seen the price of oil increase. So we have to take all these into consideration. A war with Iran would be messy, bloody, and potentially inconclusive.
What about containment? I mean, this was something that was done during the Cold War, the idea of containing nuclear ambitions. Ali, would that work in this region of the world?
Just because a country has nuclear weapons doesn't make it all-powerful. Pakistan has dozens, maybe up to 100 nuclear weapons, and it's not doing so well in a lot of ways. Its economy is in a downward spiral. It's not a great regional power like India. So Iran obtaining a nuclear weapon is not going to make it the regional hegemon. There's a lot, actually, that is constraining and containing Iran's ability to project power in the region, including the troubles facing Iran's key ally, the Syrian regime. So if even Iran manages to assemble a couple of nuclear weapons, it's not going to be instantly the great power in the Middle East. There's a lot the United States can do to contain Iran, especially as it faces increasing isolation and a deteriorating economy.
Let me get Mike from Woodstown, New Jersey, to join us on Radio Times. And Mike, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
First, a statement. This is typical. The United States' potential position in this, where we may consider military strike against Iran, is indicative of how the United States' foreign policy acts more to the benefit of Israel than it does to the American citizens. And hopefully we'll avoid that situation. Your guest brings up a good point that having a nuclear weapon does not guarantee a country, you know, economic stability or progress. I think the idea that Iran could develop nuclear weapons, one point we haven't looked at, is it may also drive some of those other countries in the Middle East a little closer to the United States in trying to distance themselves from Iran. Iran's not a suicidal nation, much like Russia. I mean, I don't think they're foolish enough to launch a military strike against Israel, knowing that Israel is actually basically owned and operated by the U.S., and we support it. That's how it's existed.
Well, let me take your comment and give Matthew Koenig a chance to weigh in on that. He said several things, including he didn't think that Iran would, in a sense, commit suicide by attacking another country, including Israel.
Yeah, the caller raises some good points. So I think he's right that Iran isn't a suicidal state. Despite all the inflammatory rhetoric, I think it has followed a fairly pragmatic foreign policy since the revolution in 1979. That said, there's a lot that could go wrong with a nuclear-armed Iran, even if they're not suicidal. The United States, I think we would agree, is not a suicidal state, but we were willing to risk nuclear war a number of times during the Cold War. Looking back, there are things that maybe we shouldn't have been risking nuclear war over. And we came close to nuclear war a number of times with the Soviet Union, for example, in the Cuban Missile Crisis. So I think even a nuclear-armed Iran, you know, even if it is rational, even if it is pragmatic, would certainly find itself in high-stakes crises with Israel, with neighboring countries, with the United States, and any one of those crises would have the potential to escalate. The caller also raised the question of Israel and whether the United States is only interested in Iran's nuclear program because of Israel. And Israel is a close ally in the region. We take their concerns seriously. But a nuclear-armed Iran poses a direct threat to the United States, and I think President Obama made that clear this week. A nuclear-armed Iran would lead to further nuclear proliferation in the Middle East. Preventing the spread of nuclear weapons is a key U.S. interest. The United States has an interest in protecting energy supplies and to make sure that there's a free flow of energy supplies from the Persian Gulf region. A nuclear-armed Iran would threaten that goal. And we want to avoid nuclear war against the U.S. homeland. And a nuclear-armed Iran could lead to a nuclear exchange with our allies or even, again, against the U.S. homeland. So this is something that the United States has an interest in preventing. It's not just something that we're doing on behalf of Israel.
Matthew Koenig is an assistant professor of government at Georgetown University, a Stanton Nuclear Security Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Also with us is Alireza Nader, senior international policy analyst at the RAND Corporation, talking about Iran, Israel, and the United States. And I do want to get some more callers in at 1-888-477-9499. But first, Ali, do you want to respond to what Matthew just said?
I don't see how Iran could threaten the U.S. homeland with a nuclear weapon at this point. Point doesn't have the capability to reach the United States. It may be experimenting with developing an ICBM, intercontinental ballistic missile, but it's not there yet. So we have many years before we reach that point, and I don't think that Iranian nuclear weapons capability is imminent or inevitable, as is often portrayed.
Let me get Chris from Reading to join our conversation. And Chris, go ahead. You are on Radio Times. Chris, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yep. I've got a question. For 50 years, the concept of mutually assured destruction kept the United States and the USSR from launching an exchange. I don't see how a nation state possessing nuclear weapons is really a threat, considering they have to consider their own people before they launch.
Do you agree with that, Matthew?
Well, as I pointed out before, I think that the Cold War was a dangerous time, and I think we sometimes forget that. The United States came very close to nuclear war a number of times with the Soviet Union. If we went back and replayed that tape, it's not at all clear to me that we'd come out as well as we did. I think we were very close to nuclear war, and I think that you know, it's possible that any one of those crises, the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Berlin Crisis, could have escalated. And so when we look at a nuclear-armed Iran, I think we have all those concerns, but I think that a nuclear-armed Iran would be even less stable than a nuclear Soviet Union was. If you look at the region, there are a lot of instabilities in the region. The countries are very close to each other. There's a history of conflict. There are proxy battles going on. And so I think the probability of escalation and the probability that things would spin out of control are much greater in the Middle East than they were during the Cold War.
Ali, do you think it's possible to live with a nuclear Iran?
I think our objective should be to prevent a nuclear-armed Iran. This is not something that is in the interest of the United States or our allies in the region and globally. And I do think to some extent it threatens international peace. But at the same time, we have to look at Iran as a country that is not all-powerful, that is much less powerful than the Soviet Union or Communist China, where when we were competing with them. So Iran has a lot of vulnerabilities that allows the United States to contain it if it develops a nuclear capability. I don't think Iran developing a nuclear weapons capability would mean the end of U.S. influence and power in the region. And the caller made an important point. In fact, the countries, the Arab countries of the Persian Gulf, the Gulf Cooperation Council countries like Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, UAE, are actually getting closer to the United States. So Iran is isolating itself. It's not helping its foreign policy in the long term or even the regime's stability by developing a nuclear weapons capability.
Chris, thanks for the call. Let's see what Brad from Dover, Delaware has to say. And Brad, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, I was just wanting to say that I think one of your callers there is rather alarmist in regards to the possibility of Iran acquiring a nuclear weapon, and within a month they could put something together. Just compare it to our nuclear weapons program over the past 50 years since the Manhattan Project. Our development of missiles and atomic bombs has cost billions upon billions to make them very reliable so they can be deployed at any time. We can reconfigure and reassemble. To believe that Iran is investing in that level of sophistication, and you can even go online and look at some of our old programs and see how sophisticated our missiles and weapon systems are, and then look at Iran. They have a website that they advertise all their defense progress. Just compare the picture of their Shabat missile to our MX missile. Just compare the picture of their research facilities to our research facilities run by the Department of Energy and Los Alamos Labs. It doesn't even come close.
Well, Brad,
so I think they're incredibly alarmist, claiming that Iran's on the verge.
Well, Brad, I appreciate the call, and Matthew, that ball is in your court. Go ahead.
Well, there's no question that the United States has a massive conventional and nuclear superiority over Iran, and will for the foreseeable future. That's not the issue. The question is, can Iran get a nuclear capability that would be very threatening to its neighbors, very threatening to the United States? And I think the answer to that question is clearly yes. So Ali has raised the point a number of times that the intelligence community says, quote, we have no hard evidence that Iran has yet made a final decision to build a nuclear weapon. And that's true, but I think that's a statement about the lack of our intelligence capabilities rather than about Iran's intentions. If you look at the circumstantial evidence, Iran engaging in work on nuclear weapons design, enriching to these high levels, there's no reason for Iran to do this if it wasn't interested in weapons. And, you know, we should put this in, you know, a bigger context. There's only been one country historically to give up nuclear weapons. South Africa gave up nuclear weapons. So once Iran acquires nuclear weapons, it's likely to retain that capability for years, for decades, maybe forever. So the caller is absolutely right that Iran doesn't have a sophisticated nuclear capability today. But over time, I think it's almost certain that if they get nuclear weapons, they will develop more sophisticated missiles, more sophisticated warheads, and will eventually have the ability to reach the U.S. homeland with a nuclear capability.
I'm wondering, Ali, and obviously the president has put a military strike on the back burner, but he didn't take it off the stove, if you'll pardon my metaphor there. But I can't. It's hard to imagine that the American public would support the U.S. attacking Iran to help Israel.
Well, if there is a U.S. military option, it's not just to help Israel. The U.S. also has many interests at stake when it comes to the Iranian nuclear weapons program, the alleged program. But there's also some divergence between Israel and the United States. A lot of Israeli leaders and policymakers feel that a nuclear-armed Iran is an existential threat, and if it's not, then it could seriously constrain Israel's ability to wage war in the Middle East. Whereas the United States is a very different country with a set of interests. We have a much bigger military. We're more powerful than Israel. So there are some common interests with Israel, but there are also some divergent interests. And a lot of people, especially lately, have argued that Israeli and U.S. interests are not identical. Also, to make a point, a lot of Israelis don't believe that military strikes against Iran will be effective. The former chief of the Israeli intelligence organization, the Mossad, has said that a military strike against Iran would be stupid, using his word, not mine. He has said it's not a good option. So a lot of Israelis are divided on this issue as well.
Matthew, we have just a couple minutes before we have to say goodbye to you and Ali. But as you look ahead, do you think it's possible for the U.S. to have a more normalized relationship with Iran?
With the current regime in power in Iran, I don't think that's possible. I think there are we have divergent interests. We have a history of mistrust, and so unless we get some kind of change in government in Iran, I think it's unlikely that the United States and Iran are going to see eye to eye. And so that's part of the reason why nuclear-armed Iran is so threatening to the United States. You know, President Bush and President Obama didn't agree on a lot, but they agreed that a nuclear-armed Iran is unacceptable. And I think on that point, they were right.
And Ali, do you think it's possible for the U.S. to normalize or have a more normalized relationship with Iran?
Yes. In the long term, I think there's a lot of potential for that because the Iranian people don't want international isolation. They don't want a bad economy. They don't want hostile relations with countries like the United States. The problem is the Iranian regime, the Islamic Republic and Iran's supreme leader. As long as Khamenei is in power, it's difficult to see the United States and Iran having a normal relationship. But in the future, Iran does have democratic norms that could facilitate a country more amenable to U.S. interests. And we have to be careful that our focus on the nuclear program in Iran does not jeopardize our long-term interests regarding Iran, and that is a more secular and democratic Iran.
Well, my thanks to both of you for joining us in this portion of Radio Times. And Ali Reza Nader, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And he's a senior international policy analyst at the RAND Corporation. And Matthew Koenig, thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
And he's an assistant professor of government at Georgetown University, a Stanton Nuclear Security Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. And waiting in the wings, we have Roya Hakakian. She's a writer, poet, and journalist born and raised in Iran. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Delaware's professional acting company, the resident ensemble players, supports WHYY, presenting Our Country's Good, March 8th through 23rd. In 1789 Australia, one man attempts to save spirits and civilize souls through a makeshift stage, a cast of condemned prisoners, and the transformational power of theater. Our Country's Good is an exciting and deeply moving tale of passion and redemption. For tickets, 302-831-2204 or rep.udel.edu.
On the next Fresh Air, Maya Rudolph, the Saturday Night Live alum, co-starred in Bridesmaids. She plays a TV talk show host in the series Up All Night, and she co-stars in the new movie Friends with Kids. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Thank you. I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. We'll hear from an expert on how to fundraise, whether you're a huge nonprofit or just trying to build a neighborhood park. Also, the newly crowned hottest pepper in the world, burning through the gloves of people picking it. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Joining us now is Roya Hakakian. She's a writer, poet, and journalist who was born and raised in a Persian Jewish family in Tehran. She emigrated with her family to the U.S. in 1985, and that was in the middle of the Iran-Iraq War. She's the author of a memoir about being a teenager in revolutionary Iran, Journey from the Land of No, and more recently a book called Assassins of the Turquoise Palace. She's a founding member of the Iran Human Rights Documentation Center, serves on the board of Refugees International. And Roya Hakakian, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's great to hear your voice again, Marty.
Thank you very much. After this week of meetings, Benjamin Netanyahu was in Washington. There were speeches before AIPAC. There were press conferences and, of course, a presidential campaign. Are you concerned about, I guess, the bellicose rhetoric that we've been hearing this week about Iran and Israel?
I am. Of course I am. I think the last thing that we need in the midst of everything that is going on in Iran in light of the recent sanctions and in the region is a war. And I think part of what really concerns me is the lack of attention to the trajectory of our Iran policy, and by our I mean the American foreign policy towards Iran in the last 32 years, because oftentimes from one administration to the next, the wheel gets reinvented again.
And there's not much understanding of this history, and I do want to get to that, but I'm assuming you have friends and associates and family maybe even in Iran today. I'm wondering just how this talk is being translated and interpreted in Iran itself among the people.
Well, there are lots of reports that come, and some of them are surprising. The degree of desperation on the part of some Iranians is to the point where some say, you know, let's just have an end to this, and if that means a war, so be it. And this is not to say that they're welcoming war, but they're really at their wit's end, and some basically are saying one way or another this situation needs to sort itself out in order for life to go on.
Resigned to war, you're saying?
Yes, I think, you know, we think of the war in Iraq and the mayhem in Pakistan and the war next door in Afghanistan. All of these wars have profoundly affected the Iranian condition, not to mention the regime itself. So I think it has, at the end, created a moment of profound uncertainty and fear inside Iran.
You wrote recently in the New York Times about a Facebook page post, someone asking you that if there is a war between Iran and Israel, and you are a Jewish born in Iran, now living in the United States, the question to you was, whose side would you be on?
Mm-hmm.
Did you find an answer to that question?
No. I mean, can anyone?
Exactly.
I mean, I felt at the moment when I first set eyes on that question, and the first thing that came to my mind was, could you ask a child to choose between two parents? Could you, you know, isn't that really an obsolete question in the 21st century now that we are really only percentage people, meaning that 20% of our makeup is from one place and then the other 75% of our makeup is from so many other places. Who's a pure anything anymore? And therefore, I think asking such questions which are at the stem, at the root of it, puritanical questions, really don't fit with the way we have been engaged culturally and been mixed up with each other physically anymore. And not to mention that it really truly broke my heart to see
that question.
Yeah.
Well, and picking up on that, and this is what you wrote in that New York Times piece, and its headline, What Two Enemies Share, talking about Israel and Iran, and they share culture, they share history, they share geography. Help us understand, I guess, the connection between these two peoples, these two countries.
Well, Jews, I mean, today we're talking, it happens to be the Festival of Purim within on the Jewish calendar, which marks one of the most important Jewish holidays of, you know, Queen Esther conquering the evil Haman within the land of Persia. I mean, on the Jewish calendar, we have a holiday that celebrates, marks the presence of Jews in Iran, and they were saved by a woman named Esther, who was allegedly a queen in Iran. So according to the Bible itself, we as Jews have produced, among other things, a royal in the Iranian history. And I think the history begins there on an upbeat note. And to the modern times, Israeli engineers, Israeli
builders,
builders, and Iranian Jews together helped build the current modern urban infrastructure that Iran has thrived on in the last century, and has caused Iran to be far more ahead of where the neighbors are regionally, because these changes occurred.
You also write about an Iranian, and this was during our World War II, that an Iranian ambassador helped to get passports and documents to aid refugees, Jews that were fleeing Nazi Germany.
That's right. He was an ambassador to Iran's mission in France at the time, and he is the equivalent of the Iranian Schindler, a man who believed that you know, the Nazis were wrong and did everything he possibly could to save them from annihilation.
Do you think there's anything left of this goodwill and this history?
I think. Yes, I think what's very promising, and the story that has yet to emerge but is brewing, is the story of the curiosity, if not the affinity, that 33 years of negative propaganda on behalf of the Iranian regime has created among average Iranians toward Jews in Israel. I mean, there is a point at which tyrannical propaganda backfires inside a nation, and that moment has really arrived in Iran. And if only Israel, and if only the American Jewish community and Jews everywhere became aware of the fact that the Iranian nation have reached a point where they really want to know the truth about the Jews, Jewish history, the Holocaust, what happened, an account that isn't coming from President Ahmadinejad, who's been denying much of Jewish history.
And how many Jews are living in Israel today?
In Iran?
Excuse me, in Iran today?
There is about anywhere between 15,000 to 25,000. And there continues to be, to everyone's surprise, an infrastructure still for the Jewish community, meaning synagogues and schools, and even a representative in the Iranian parliament or the Majlis.
In fact, you say it's the largest home to Jews in the Middle East after Israel and Turkey.
That's right. And part of that is precisely because that goodwill that you just mentioned continues to exist within the Iranian public, who understand that Jews are the most indigenous population inside Iran.
And that's Roya Hakakian, our third of three guests in this hour of Radio Time. She's a writer and a poet, also a journalist. In fact, born and raised in a Persian Jewish family in Tehran, as I said, immigrated to the U.S. with her family in the 1980s. I wrote about her childhood in a book called Journey from the Land of No. Also wrote a book called Assassins of the Turquoise Palace, a founding member of the Iran Human Rights Documentation Center. Also serves on the board of Refugees International. We invited her to join us today on Radio Time to talk about the growing, what appears to be growing, conflict between Israel and Iran. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And Roy, I remember interviewing you and talking about your childhood, growing up before and then under the Iranian Revolution. But it appeared that after the Iranian Revolution, Jews like your family were targeted.
Yes, but they weren't singled out as a religious minority. It's a very complex thing to try to explain, because while Jews lost a lot of rights in Iran after the rise of this current regime, they weren't singled out in that the regime was really drawing red lines between those who they considered to be on their side and those they considered to be enemies. And a lot of people were on the other side of their red line, and a lot of minorities, a lot of Muslim Iranians who happened to be secular were on the other side as well. So while being a Jew certainly was among one of the least desirable things you could possibly be in post-revolutionary Iran, at the same time, it wasn't the worst thing you could possibly be.
It wasn't the worst thing. And I guess if you were an opponent of that regime, that made you a target.
That's right. If you were a member of the opposition and you were a Muslim, you were in far worse shoes than you were as a Jew. Or if you were a member of the Baha'i minority, religious minority, you were far worse off than a Jewish person.
I was talking with my previous guest, and it was more of a debate about what to do about a nuclear Iran. But from your context in that country, what have been the effects of sanctions on the Iranian people?
Well, you know, I was in Iran when the first sanctions were placed, and on Iran, and you know, while it created some hindrances and some difficulties inside Iran, they really didn't bite, so to speak. But this last round of sanctions are probably most definitely are the most biting sanctions that the international community and the United States have ever placed Iran on. They're meaningful. They're having an effect. They are more than just a rhetorical notion that there are sanctions just for us to feel good about, you know, our opposition to Iran. They do far more than that. And that reflects itself in the fall of the value of the Iranian currency, which within the first few days of the placement of these sanctions dropped to 30% of its original value. And it's showing, reverberating in terms of its effects on every possible dimension, but economical, most importantly.
But do you think sanctions are often described as a blunt weapon, but do you think it would create within that country enough discontent that Iranian people could, if not pressure their government, even put some kind of, and we know, of course, there have been protests in the past, but pressure the government to go to the negotiating table, for instance?
Well, they certainly can press the government to go to the negotiating table, and they have already said that they would. What I would like to see is to create the circumstances to recreate the conditions that we saw in Iran in June of 2009 in the aftermath of the presidential elections. That's what I think the international community will ultimately like to do, is to bring back the million marchers and protesters who took to the streets of Tehran and, in my view, created the sea change that the region is seeing today. I mean, a lot of people think that something happened in Iran in 2009, it emerged and then it died away, whereas I think something, a spark, was fired in Iran in 2009 and then caught on elsewhere, caught on in Tunisia, in Egypt, in Libya, in Syria, and has yet to return to Iran or to do what it has done elsewhere inside Iran itself. And I think it is really with the changing of this regime, with the downfall of this cast of characters, that the lasting peace and the lasting stability can come to Iran.
Let me see if I can squeeze one caller on. We have Henry from, looks like Florence, New Jersey. Henry, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Okay, I just have a question for the speaker, guest. I mean, what is the response of the Jewish community in America about the situation unfolding in Iran?
And you know, Henry, that there's not one response.
Okay. In general, being a journalist, what does she feel that is happening in the Jewish community?
Ruth, do you want to take that?
Well, you're right, Marty, that it's a varied response. It has a wide range. But I think the predominant voices within the American Jewish community belong to those who speak out of a position of fear that Iran is Iran's regime is very dangerous and has to be stopped. While that is absolutely true, I think there are lots of other ways of dealing with this, which can bring the element of hope into this moment of legitimate fear that could then change our perspective towards Iran. It could create a far more sophisticated landscape of what is going on inside the country as opposed to just a singular view on the regime itself. And that's what I really hope we can do by carrying on with this discussion, that our perspective on Iran would be shortchanged, and our policy would be shortchanged if it were only based on the fear we feel towards the regime, and not the hope that that the people of Iran can potentially present.
Well, Roya Hakakian, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And she's a writer, poet, journalist, born and raised in Iran, lives now in the United States, author most recently of a book called Assassins of the Turquoise Palace, founding member of the Iran Human Rights Documentation Center, and she also serves on the board of Refugees International. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program, including Facebook and Twitter, email, and the archives. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. We'll be right back. And do stay.